Hello and welcome. My name is Julie Clegg and this is World Class Investigator, the podcast for those of you who want to rise to the top of your profession, build an influential global network of like-minded professionals, and create a legacy of integrity and excellence. I'm glad you're here. And once again, it's time to take another step in your journey towards becoming truly world class. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the World Class Investigator podcast. We're here today with Jenny Radcliffe. Now, Jenny is a very unusual type of professional. She calls herself the human hacker. And what that means is that she engages in what's known as social engineering. So this is a fairly new term. I've only started hearing this term in the last probably 4 or 5 years. And it really relates to, and I'm going to let Jenny explain this herself, but this really relates to people that use other people or communicate with other people or have other people tell them information under the guise of it potentially being something else. So you're asking for one thing, but really you're seeking information that allows you to do something else in the bigger picture. And I'm going to let Jenny explain exactly what that looks like in her own words and in her world, which is very interesting and very exciting. And Jenny really is at the top of her field in this type of work. So welcome, Jenny. Thank you for being here. It's fantastic to talk to you again. We've seen each other recently, and I loved working with you. So it's great to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for asking me. I loved working with you as well. I appreciate it. And yeah, I mean. To describe, I think you described it really well, actually. I'd say I was the people hacker. I think someone else nicked human hacker.
But right. Well, thank you for correcting that.
But social engineering is really obtaining information or data or even access to things which people would be better to keep secret. So it, predominantly my work would be for corporate clients. And what they asked me to do, and I'm keen to point out that I am asked to do this. Before I tell your listeners anything else, I am hired by people to do this. I don't just do it for the fun, although it can be fun. What happens is corporations, organizations ask me to test their security systems, but I'm not a technical person. In fact, as you know, because we were together, I'm probably the least technical person you'll ever come across. But they asked me to try and gain access to their information, to their premises, to their data without using technology. So the tools are influence, persuasion, psychology, negotiation skills. And there is a certain amount of, you know, I'm always conscious that you're a police officer, you were, but obviously there's a certain amount of lock picking and, you know, out and out burglary as well. But I mean, I'm hired to do it.
As long as there's consent, I mean, that's the differentiator, because it, you know, I mean, you and I, when we were together, we had some great conversations, and one of the, you know, it's interesting because I was, because I worked undercover and I did undercover work for quite some time. It's often said that, you know, undercover work is you're very close to the line, of having to think like a criminal. And so, you know, particularly when you're doing covert work, you're having to think about, okay, well, how would a criminal do this? How do I behave like a criminal? How do I act? And that really is a big part of what you do, is that psychological side of it. So why don't you explain that a little more about how you get yourself in the mindset?
Yeah, I mean, I call it the attack perspective, and it's just something that you, I suppose to a certain degree, I had some good teachers. I had family who were in the business, as it were. but there's a certain amount of, I guess it's something about the way people think, that if you think along, you know, normal sort of tram lines that everyone else thinks about, you don't see the little details that enables you to do this stuff, right? So I guess what we're looking to do is to approach a building or even an individual. And this makes me sound really evil. And again, just pointing out, I never said I was Snow White, but I am on the side of the angels. But what we do is we look for the vulnerable points, for the weak spots in the target. And that would not necessarily be the weak spots that someone who wasn't in the industry look for. So, you know, one of the things I talk about, I was hired to break into a London, very famous London building. And, you know, I knew lots of people had attempted that same job before, and they'd always sort of gone through, you know, got sort of forced doors, pick locks and those types of things. But the way I looked at it was I always look for the people, and I noticed there was a coffee franchise in the building, and that means there's got to be a delivery. There's probably a smoking area for staff. And that's how I got into that building. So it's about looking at something in a completely sideways way. Most people just see what's obvious and then maybe a few things underneath. When you're trying to think like a criminal, and you're exactly right with what you said, what you're really looking for is, you know, the unusual access points and weaknesses to a building or even to a person. And that's the pressure point that we push, really.
It's absolutely fascinating. And I love this stuff. This, you know, the most exciting and the best work I ever did was the covert investigation type of work. And I still love that. I'm still fascinated by the psychology of what makes somebody think a certain way. And one of the other podcast guests I've had on this show was David Vidaset. And one of the things that he and I talked about was motivation. And motive and motivation. What makes somebody do what they do? How does somebody think in a certain way that's unusual or different to the way that 90% of us think? How is somebody wired to see those gaps that you see, the vulnerabilities? And what can you explain how you got into this? How did this come about for you as a career? Because it's certainly not something you go to university and train for.
God,
so
no.
How did you get into this work?
Well, there's two things I'd say. I want to address that point of motivation, if I can, because, and it sort of leads into the second part of the question. So when I actually also do a lot of corporate training, and one of the things I've taught for many, many years is advanced negotiation skills. And I sort of the skills that I have are all under sort of one umbrella, really, which is the sort of deep understanding of people, I guess. Mm. And motivation is a huge part of what I teach, because what I say is if you need to persuade somebody, if you need to get someone to do something that perhaps they don't want to do or that they don't yet realize is in their interest. And this is true from criminal and crisis negotiations, as you would know, as well as sort of more mundane corporate stuff, which actually isn't that mundane 9 times out of 10. It's more exciting than some of the criminal stuff very often.
Yeah.
What you have to do to really understand what motivates people is to understand that which they fear and that which they desire. So, you know, at a very basic level, we all want to be safe. It's sort of the hierarchy needs thing, Maslow. We all want to be safe. We want to have, you know, shelter, warmth, enough money, and be happy. And then it gets into more complicated sort of things like altruism and stuff. And what we're afraid of and what we don't want is things like being in pain or being unhappy and that type of thing. So to tap into someone, and in my job, I really do have to tap into people I need to understand someone very, very quickly and build rapport very quickly. So what I'm looking at when I'm investigating somebody, and I say investigating, no one who I'm speaking to, by the way, but all that research that goes in prior to me hitting a client, I have a lot of research. I like to know the people in the client's organization better than they do. By the time I show up on the door, I should know everyone in that organization really well through the research and, you know, the reconnaissance and the OSINT actually part that I do. And it's actually really funny. I was talking to a lady today who does a similar job, and we were talking about times when I've been inside the building and I've bumped into a member of staff. And although it's the first time I've ever bumped into them, I feel like I know them because I've been investigating them for weeks. And I nearly say hello, you know, hello, how's the rabbit? Do you know? But they wouldn't know me at all because they're obviously that, and it would be really creepy if I did it. So for me to know someone that well, I really need to know the last thing that they want, the last thing they will give up. Because if I know that stuff, I know what motivates them. And that's what helps me get inside and do the job well. As I say, it does sound rather sinister when I put it like that, but that is what I do.
Well, it is sinister. It is, certainly dancing around the dark edges of the psyche and of people, as you say, people's very base desires and needs and fears and the things that keep people up at night, the things that people don't want to happen. People don't want to, and it goes, you mentioned some of the very basic things, food, shelter, that kind of thing. But if we go deeper than that and go right into the people's psychological needs, psychological desires, psychological fears, people don't want to be shamed. They don't want to be humiliated. They don't want to be embarrassed in front of their coworkers or their friends or their family. They really, really want to be revered. They want to be accepted. People want to feel like other people like them. They want to be admired. They may want a promotion at work. They want to feel valued and they don't want to feel vulnerable.
And it's a potent mix and it's different for everyone in lots of ways. So there's lots of sort of individual elements that go into that, but there's a lot of commonality and a lot of what you said, there's the commonality. You know, most people want to belong to some sort of group. Most people want a quiet life, you know, they like to know. And I don't mean that they don't want excitement, but they don't want sort of disruption and argument and things that unsettle them. And there'll be people thinking, well, oh no, I'm not that easily read. Everyone I ever read thinks that they're a mystery and an enigma and that we will never work them out. I mean, you must have this too in some of the things you do, but we will never work them out, and they're far deeper than everyone else, and there's much more sort of to them. And I did a demo of why that isn't the case for a large group in London not too long ago, where I used the same techniques as stage psychics, and I did readings on a couple of people in the audience. And, you know, you can be scarily accurate with that knowledge of psychology and then just, you know, reading the body language and the reactions. So, you know, there are some things that are common to all of us and we're all vulnerable to. And then there are some things that are very particular to the individual. And I try and tap into the first layer and then find the people in that second layer. But bearing in mind, the job is, that's why I have to be the most ethical person in that building. So my job involves me absolutely uncovering all of that and then, you know, never ever using it for ill, forgetting about it, destroying the case files, and just being really ethical about it, because you know you're dealing with someone's calm and peace of mind there, and that's not something that we mess with lightly.
Yeah, that you make a really good point there, because and I know this from the work that I do, that you do end up being in receipt and in possession of some very personal information, and how you deal with that will determine really ultimately your success or failure. You could get into that building or into that situation, but that vulnerability can't be acted upon. It can only be acted upon within the confines of what you're tasked to do, and then nothing more. And then it's up to the company. This is the same as my work, is that I do my investigation and I hand it over, and what that person does with that information then is up to them. But for my part, the work is done and everything is destroyed and everything is wiped clean.
It's true. And it's so important. And the thing is, I use a quote a lot, and it was Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I use it when I do public speaking on the topic, and I say, everyone has got a public life, a private life, and a secret life. And the thing is, and I always say we need to try and keep it that way, you know? But the thing is, my whole, I strike gold if I hit your secret life. You know, if someone's hired me to do that, then it's the secret things that people will protect, and the secret things that people will pursue. And that's your motivation right there. But what I will say is, as you say, how I use that, often I don't need to use it. I see it and it's too deep. But always remember that the reason I'm asked to do it is to replicate those dangerous criminal attacks of people who really would use that information maliciously. Once we find that information out, really my job then is an education piece to help people be more private, protect themselves better, and guard that secret life from people who would use it to hurt them. So, you know, that's my kind of get out of jail free, is that we do it to help protect. For sure.
Absolutely. It's like any other, you know, there's tons of penetration testing companies out there that do this very same thing, but technically. So they try and access somebody's technical systems, their computer systems. And there are, you know, again, there's a fine line there with all of this when it comes to ethics and whether or not there is always a point where you are in receipt of so much information that you could use it for good or evil. You know, the technology or the work, the information itself is neutral. It's how it's used as to what's going to happen with that. So you've got some penetration testers that test systems without being asked to, and then will go to that company and say, hey, I found this, you know, gaping hole in your system, I'll fix it for you for this amount of money.
It's essentially extortion, really.
It's the same kind of thing. It's either you either have consent or you don't have consent. If you, there's a fine line between breaking into somebody's system and then trying to expose that vulnerability to them without somebody asking you to do that and then trying to get them to pay you afterwards, or doing it the other way, which is being hired, doing exactly the same thing, having the same information, but then doing the piece that you do that. And what you've said is so important, that you then provide the education, you're there to help them, you're there to talk to their staff, to talk to them and say, these are your vulnerabilities. And if I was, you know, Mr. Bad Guy, then this is how I would be able to get into your building, your system, or whatever it is, your task. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that has massive implications. You know, you may be talking about somebody's business, but that has implications at home, in their family, because these things are interchangeable now, that you've got, you know, nothing is really in a silo anymore, because we're all carrying these devices. And we take them home from work, and we take home to our workplace as well. It's interchangeable. So, you know, we don't have these silos of information. Everything crosses over.
And that's how we get people to protect themselves. Because if we go into a business, if I go into a business and say, look, we found all, you know, get all the people in front of me and say, we found all these vulnerabilities, and what you have to do now is use strong passwords and be careful about what you put online and, you know, watch out for patterns and things. People are not interested. There is security fatigue. They just cannot get with constantly being told what to do. But if I go in, and I have a few different sort of talks I do, but if I go in and I say, you are important enough to be hacked, and it's not because you're rich or, you know, quote unquote important, it's because you're a link in a chain, you're a node on this network that leads us to your company and to your contacts and to all sorts of things. So you have to protect yourself, not just to protect the company, but you have to understand that you are a vessel for us. You know, you're going to be the conduit, the channel for us to get to other people. And anything that happens to you as a result of that, for criminals, is purely collateral damage. They don't care. And so, you know, your family could be impacted, your finances, your identity. And if you say that to people, they can see that it's personal, and they can see that makes sense. And I think one of the reasons I kind of am hired to talk about it so much is because those are the terms I put it in. I don't put it in technical terms because I'm not a technical person. But I'll say, you know, if I was a criminal, I would use this information to hurt you or to quote unquote, you know, persuade you, to coerce you into letting me into the office or whatever. And people understand that. And I think it's a very raw message and it has to be delivered very sensitively and in the right way. But that's the message that hits home. And that's why, much as I laugh and joke about what I do, and I'll talk about how I got into it, and that, you know, there's a lot of kind of theatre to it all, really that's why I do what I do, because I want people who are not in security and who are not technical people to just be more careful about the things that they love and about their own identity, because that's really under threat these days. And I know that if someone gave me a technical explanation, and they have done forever, I switch off. So of course other people will. And so that was really my, speak about motivation, that's really mine. It's just to try and make people, in a non-technical, sort of vaguely entertaining way, so I hold attention, aware of the risks, really, that we, you know, in this sort of modern digital world. But I work with the oldest trick in the book, which is getting in someone's head, really, I guess.
Yeah, so you're doing this vital work. And it's funny because there's tons and tons of educators in this space. So lots and lots of people that are providing training courses or providing workshops, webinars, you name it, when it comes to either cybersecurity or it comes to, you know, personal protection online, all of those fields, there are lots and lots of educators, but people don't necessarily want to, you know, I think in those situations, I read a statistic once that said people only retain something like 20% of that information when they go and attend a training course or a conference. They don't retain a lot of the information, but what you do is you make it, first of all, so personal that they feel like it's about them. It resonates. It hits their core vulnerability, and you're working with fear. You're working with somebody's very base instincts and base needs, base desires and fears that they can't ignore it and they don't want to ignore it. And it's not like going and sitting on a training course and picking out the bits that are relevant to them. You're honing right into something that's absolutely relevant to them and playing into that fear. So it's a very psychological game, if you like.
I always thought that if, when I trained people to avoid what I do and the connected risks, that I would use, and this is so damning, I would use the same psychological tricks that I use to get into the building and into their heads to get the training into their head. And so there's hypnotic statements, there's cognitive bias, there's interrogation type techniques that you'd be familiar with, you know, elicitation, and there's all these ways that you can make someone someone remember something that isn't there. And I remember you and I probably over a beverage talking about this and talking about witness statements, though. Do you remember? And saying, you know, you have to be so careful the way that you talk to somebody because you can implant details in their head. Right. So, you know, how fast was the green car going? And then people will say, oh, that green car, I remember that it was going so fast. And there wasn't one, you know, it was things like, and we were chatting about it, I think, in Scotland or something. But the thing is that, you know, if you reverse that and use it in a positive way, I can make some of the training land and stay because I'm using the same kind of juicy psychology for a positive cause. And so people do remember it more than other things. And that's all I should say about my methodology there, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember those conversations, and it's funny because I've seen you in action, and it was interesting spending all the time we traveled up the country together on the train, and just watching you at work, watching you win people over very easily. You are a master at your craft. See you talking to people, just random strangers on the train, and the information you're able to elicit from them, and you know, by the time we arrive at our next station, you're their best friend. It's very fascinating to watch.
And the thing is, I had no agenda to doing that. I think that's partly why I'm good at my job. I really do like people, and I feel that everyone's got a really interesting story, and you know, it doesn't take much to get someone to relax and tell you it. And I've no malintent, and I think most people pick up on that as well. I think if I was doing that maliciously, people's some spidey sense with, you know, something inside them might kind of throw up a shield. But day to day, I mean, and I was always acutely aware of your, you know, basilisk stare, watching me really carefully and just sort of going, I can see what you're doing there. So, you know, but no, it's true. And people talk to me and tell me stuff all the time, but I've been doing it for so long, ever since I was little, really, that it does come naturally to me. And I do like people a lot, you know.
Yes. Yeah, and that comes through, and I think it's probably essential in what you do that you have to, you know, you have to be open yourself, and you have to be receptive to anything that people say. And, you know, I think I find that when you share a little bit of information with somebody else, they are more likely to share with you. So when you expose your own vulnerability, then other people tend to drop their guard as well. So there are psychological ways of, you know, having people share information with you that they wouldn't necessarily share with other people. And that kind of elicitation. This is one of the reasons why I believe that, you know, one of the best skills an investigator can learn is really good interrogation and interviewing.
Because then they tell you then, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. They'll tell you. If people will open up. But it is a toolkit, isn't it? I mean, for me, it's something I have to teach. I have to say to people that empathy is one thing, sympathy is another thing, liking people, all of that stuff's great, but there's a toolkit to doing for proper questioning techniques and for listening. You know, I do think that has to be taught, don't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's certain things, you know, and I think part of it is nature and part of it is nurture. So for me, I am innately curious. I ask a lot of questions, and I tend to apologize to people just in normal everyday life when I'm not working with them or trying to elicit information, because in any conversation, I tend to just ask a lot of questions. I want to know somebody. I want that person to tell me as much as possible about them, because I'm interested. I'm just interested in people. I'm like you. That's what makes me a profiler and do what I do. And a good investigator is the fact that I am just curious. But if I hadn't had some training in how to focus that curiosity in the right way, how to get somebody to share information with me, then you've got this great skill, but you're really rudderless in that you are not focusing it and making the most of it. So you can have great skills. For myself, I have a lot of empathy. So I'm able to put myself in the position of somebody else, but that's not a useful skill. It's just a character trait unless you can hone it into an investigative mindset and an investigative skill.
And I would say that was really true. And it's particularly true. I do a lot of lie detection work. I've been in deception studies for many years. And one of the things in the interrogation of that, you know, and that's been done with law enforcement over the years, is, you know, like you say, you're rudderless. With the characteristics, it's a nice conversation, but you're rudderless. But what interrogation skills teach you is, and this is, like I say, the place I've used the most is in lie detection, fraud detection, is to get to the heart of the matter. So people can talk for any amount of time about details of a lie, you know, that are not relevant to the crime or to what's taking place that they want to hide. And if you know, we can chat away for hours on that. It's pleasant and under no stress. And I think what the skills teach you is to know when to home into what really needs to be answered. And to know when to put them back onto that kind of flat line of emotion and talk about the weather, the traffic, the football or whatever, and then watch for the reactions when we get back onto that kind of hot topic. And that's a skill that, for me, all of the natural ability that that I perhaps had wouldn't have accounted for much if I hadn't, you know, gone and learnt those kind of techniques, really. But then a lot of what I did was, you know, I went out and got the education. I wanted to know how to do it. You know, I was never in law enforcement officially. Dealt with the police a lot, but was never in law enforcement. You know, but I wanted some of those skills. You know, I was really interested in whether that could be done well and how it was done and all that type of thing, I guess. Which I suppose brings us...
And I think that's how it starts. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, which I suppose brings us back to the whole, how did you even do it? But yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, exactly. And one of the things I... When we talk about how somebody gets started, one of the big questions I often get asked is, how do I get into doing what you do? How does somebody become an investigator or the type of investigator that you are? Have this range of skill set, and it comes back to this nature and nurture skill set together. So it's a case of, okay, well, take what you're interested in, take what you're curious about, take what you're good at, take what aligns with your morals and your ethics, and mix that all together. And I kind of put it together in a bit of a Venn diagram, and that sweet spot in the middle is where you will excel as an investigator. So one of the examples I like to use is, if you're, you know, say you're a university student and you're very interested in makeup, or you're very interested in handbags or purses or running shoes or whatever it is, if that's your passion and you know an awful lot about it and you want to be an investigator and you're, but you really care about things like human trafficking or modern slavery, then there's ways that you can combine all of those skills together to investigate that thing. So you may investigate things like the supply chain of where counterfeit goods are coming from and trace it back in the supply chain to the originating factories, you know, wherever they are, and investigate how those counterfeit goods are being made and whether there's any modern slavery involved in that and what the supply chain is, whether it's linked to organized crime. So I think you can always find a way to combine all of those things. And it sounds like that's exactly what you've done. You're a fantastic example of somebody that hasn't gone to university or gone specifically to train in this craft that you do, but you found this passion, this thing that you're good at, this thing that resonates with you and is and fits with your personality, your ethics, your morals, and also the thing that you're interested in. And then you've gone out and got the training to supplement that and become, you know, an expert in your field.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really true. I think the reason that, you know, hard work is a massive part of it as well. And I'm often asked the same thing, you know, can I get to do your job? Because your job sounds really cool. And it is cool a lot of the time. But it takes so much hard work to do it and to learn how to do it. But I think that aside, I'm a niche within a niche. And I think, and that's really what you're saying, it's taking these different strands of what you're passionate about, what you're good at, what you've learned, and kind of the skill for me, and it really only came in terms of security a few years ago, was really realizing that the industry was booming and that within that industry, I had something, a USP in business terms to offer. Because my formal education was not connected because nobody taught this at the time. And very few people actually teach it now. In fact, I'm often asked by various academic institutions to do guest lectures or even to collaborate on some cyber security courses, degrees and things, because it's not really written about that well. It tends to be social engineering tends to be a module on a cybersecurity degree. You know, obviously now gradually it's becoming more and more of a taught topic and everything. But I don't think at the time I went to university, I don't think even if I'd have realised this was the job I was going to do, and it was the job I'd always done, I couldn't have found a course that taught it anyway. I mean, no one taught it. I mean, when you think about it, cybersecurity degree courses and master's degree courses have only really just proliferated in the last few years, let alone something as niche as social engineering. So I couldn't have done it anyway. But in a way, everything else I did led to this.
Right. Yeah. And that's often the case, is that you don't realize what it is you're doing until you're in it. And then you find out that there's a name for it, or that it's actually a thing. It's the same as cyber psychology. This is an emerging field of psychology, and there's still very few universities or very few places in the world that offer any kind of courses in cyber psychology, and particularly degrees. There's only probably less than half a dozen universities in the world that offer a degree in cyber psychology, but it's really an emerging field. And that's exactly what you're in, is something that people have really always done, but not necessarily in a technical way, and not necessarily has it had a name.
I mean, all the technology did was give a different set of tools for the con, because essentially I'm a con artist, really. And you know, OSINT, and again, you and I spoke about this at length, but OSINT was the game changer for social engineering, because I started out as I did some sort of a misspent youth in Liverpool as a child. I was babysat by various members of my family, and we were interested in breaking into buildings, and which I realised is, you know, we've just lost half your listeners probably, but
no, it's fascinating. It really,
and it started out, and you know, lots of people have done this. You know, people come up to me all the time and say they did the same thing. It started out with, like, in your neighbourhood, there's an abandoned house, and wouldn't it be cool to go into that house and see if it's haunted? And then wouldn't it be cool to go into the house at night and sleep over to see if it's haunted? And, you know, it literally was that innocent. And it was very, you know, I was a well brought up girl, you know, you don't steal anything and you certainly don't damage anything. And kind of because that was the case, I learned to pick locks and things. I mean, I don't know how good I'd be at it now because the locks have changed, but, you know, I'm talking about sort of the early 80s, mostly because I was too scared to damage a lock, because that would be a bad thing to do, right? But I mean, I was in the building.
And this is where you're learning your morality, right? But this is how we learn and how we become who we are, because we test these things as children and in our teenage years. This is where we find who we're going to be as adults, and what defines us and our morality and our ethics and where our boundaries are and how we fit and how our career ultimately molds into that. I mean, there's very, very successful CEOs that are as psychopathic as some of the serial killers that are in jail. But some people go some way and some people go the opposite way. You know, they say that they say that undercover work and covert work is so similar in mindset to criminal behavior, just like what you're doing, that it is literally just the other side of the train tracks from going in a different direction. And all that keeps us from going one way or another is our morality, our ethics, our upbringing, and the ways that we're taught and how we figure out ourselves the path of our life and whether we're going to be a good or bad person.
And like some of the people from when I was a kid who were doing similar types of things, you know, are dead. You know, it was a rough place to grow up, are dead, or, you know, I've had horrible lives, really. And, you know, I still see and sort of you hear things about people from the neighborhood and everything. And so, you know, it does matter. And I guess you're right. And I didn't really think about it that way before, but there were always these lines that we wouldn't cross. You know, we wouldn't damage things. We wouldn't take anything. In fact, the one, you know, one group of criminals I really hate is burglars. I think it's the most awful violation of someone's personal space. Yes. But yet I'm basically a professional burglar and break into corporate premises all the time at their request. I'll just say that again.
Right.
But I did, you know, in the beginning, it wasn't at their request. We just saw buildings that looked interesting, that we felt that, you know, it might be a challenge to break into or not. And I figured out, Julie, that if I took an average, bear in mind, I started when I was seven. Right. If I took an average, of buildings per year, and I won't say how many because it'll give my age away, I've probably broken into 600 buildings in my life, which is just awful.
Right. So you're an expert. I mean, if you, you know, because I know you and because I know the work that you do and because I know, you know, you and I have spent so much time together, I know your moral compass and I know that you are on the side of good, not on the side of bad, and your desire, your base desire, you've developed this skill through curiosity, but your desire is to help people. So you may have the same set of skills as a bad guy, just like, you know, often a lot of the work that hackers, you know, you've got the ethical hackers, you've got white hats and black hats. They've all got the same skill set. Some of them use it for good. Some of them use it for bad. And I think it's very, very important to not have to justify that. You're doing work that you're paid to do and you've become an expert at it over your lifetime, just like somebody who's a hacker who started hacking at age 7 years old or 11 years old and at first doesn't know their boundaries, doesn't know where their moral boundaries are. And until you bump up against those boundaries, until you do something that you realize, no, you know what? That makes me uncomfortable. I don't like that part of myself. That doesn't feel good to me. So that's my boundary. And then you try something else and it will send you in one direction or another based on your own internal ethics and your own internal morals, which, you know, which come from any number of directions. So I think it's, you know, what you do could well be perceived as, okay, well, that's, you know, bordering on slightly...
Arresty?
Yeah, dubious or slightly, you know, there could be a criminal element to it. But you could say that about really a lot of people that are involved in investigation that or anybody that's doing surveillance. Yeah. I mean, you're effectively stalking.
And I don't get it. You know, I don't get people saying that to me at all, really. I mean, it's very, very rare someone will say, that seems like a bad thing to do or even right. to get to it was a bad thing to do. I just don't get that kind of feedback. And when I give talks and things, yeah, I'm very cheeky about, well, you know that. But, you know, so I'll say things like you said, white hat and a black hat. And I say, there's no such thing. There's only 50 shades of grey. And they'll say, oh, does that mean you're an ethical hacker? And I say, oh, I don't really like the word ethics. But actually, you're right. And it's actually the highest ethical code of you know, most people I know. Professionally, I've just developed it. And I think that's another reason people open up to me and tell me things and become my best friend by the end of the train journey, like that lady and that you were talking about, is because they know. I think somewhere deep down, people know that I can trust this person. I'm not saying I'm Snow White or I'm, you know, great, you know, completely not human. I'm very human, but I know when... Because of the job, I just know what's kind of what makes someone vulnerable and you know, and it's kind of, I would never betray that. So people sort of, I think even just a casual acquaintance sort of just relaxes because why wouldn't you? I think that's something that people have often asked me how to grab that, you know, how can we grab that instant rapport and stuff. And, you know, there are ways and means to do it. But bottom line is, I think it actually comes, I'm really happy in my job. I really feel like I do the job I was meant to do. So I like to talk about it and I'm happy to share stuff about it. And I think that's really what makes people, that's why I like people as well, because they always go, oh, that's such an interesting job. In fact, I remember saying this to you as well. There are times when I tell them I sell curtains, because if someone asks me what I do, and I'm really tired and I don't want to be rude and I'm English, right? And I can't be rude. I know that if I say, oh, well, you know, I'm basically a burglar, that will not be the end of that conversation. And there are times when you just don't want to have that conversation. So I'm a trainer, and like cab drivers and things will say, oh, what's your training? And you go, oh, God. So I was trying to think of the most boring thing. And I thought, well, maybe selling curtains wouldn't really, you know, especially if it's a man, you know, I sell curtains for a living. Oh, okay. And then you can tell they don't believe me. Anyway, that's a bit off.
But they don't really want to talk to you anymore either, so that's fine.
No.
Do you have any examples that you can share with us? Any cases that you've worked on or any really interesting things that you've done? What are you most proud of that you've managed to achieve? Obviously, you don't have to name names, but give us some examples of the kind of work that you do.
I think in terms of most proud of, I've managed to penetrate a lot of organisations whose job it is to keep the infrastructure of certainly the UK safe. And I know that by managing to do that, they have hardened all their security. And I think that makes me very proud to do that. But I'm kind of, I'm proud of little wins, people coming up and saying, you know, I heard you speak and that sounds like a cool thing to do. And I've gone off and looked into it. And I think I can change, particularly if they're in a job they hate. You know, I'm going to dump this job I hate and I'm going to get into something that I enjoy. Not necessarily the same thing as me, but the idea that, you know, if you work hard and you train yourself and you tap into your natural abilities, that actually you can probably make a living from something that you love. And I think when I hear someone will say to me, you know, you just carved this career out. You just work really hard. And I'm going to do the same. I'm proudest of that because I know what it's like to be in a job that you hate. And I know that it's suffocating and that people just feel like there's no way out and they feel financially trapped and things like that. So if I ever inspire someone to just say, no, you know, because I really planned to do this as well. I mean, I knew I had the skills and I had the experience, but once I realized there was a market for it, I really said that these are the skills that I really need to do this. These are the gaps and this is how I focus. And then I worked really hard to get this. So, you know, I love the idea of someone seeing that and perhaps thinking they could do something similar.
Yeah, it's fun. It's amazing because, you know, to make somebody aware that people will pay for these skills because, you know, it's beneficial. And that's the same with most entrepreneurial things is find something that you love, find something that aligns with your, you know, your internal moral compass, find something that you're good at, combine those things, and then find a way to make other people need it. Find a way to use what you have to help other people. And that's what you've done as an entrepreneur, is to take the skills that you knew you had, find a way to make a living from it in a way that is going to be beneficial to other people. And, you know, you've got a career doing something that you love. And you know, not everybody has that. But most people want that. You don't want to work for 30 years in a job that you hate just to finally retire and look back over your life and think, well, you know, what have I done?
I mean, the thing is, I always did this, but I was training people in business. I was a lecturer in a few MBAs. I mean, I still am, but it's much more specific to this side of the business. But I was, you know, I had a respectable career working for major corporates. I was actually from procurement and supply chain. And it's funny because you were saying about the modern slavery thing, but I mean, from a security point of view, I'll very often hit a client through their supply chain because I know it so well, but also because if you've got a huge company, they'll have resources invested in security, but their supply chain very often won't. And so, you know, that'll be a weak link in the network. But, you know, I mean, it wasn't that I didn't do it. It was just that I think there was some serendipity in that the security industry just went crazy. It started to go mental about 5 years ago, and now it's absolutely on steroids. It's just insane. And I saw that there was an opportunity to do it, but I'd always done it. But you're right. It was, And I just didn't think it was my main living, you know, it was my main living was something else. And actually all the skills combined, but you asked me for examples. I can give you some. I broke into a zoo. So one of the first targets that I had was a zoo when I was seven. And I said to all my cousins and to all their friends, yeah, I really want to get into a zoo at night and see the lions at night.
That sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
I wanted to know if the lions were locked away in their little cage or whatever you call it thing. And they're not, I can tell you. And that didn't put me off, and it should have done. So I remember I had a Sesame Street torch and I shined it through the bars of where we thought this lion's enclosure was. And literally this yellow eye looking back at me from about 6 inches just through a fence. And then the thing went mental. And we all sort of ran out of the zoo. But, you know, back in the day, there wouldn't have been any cameras or alarms or anything, really. Just probably a security card with a newspaper asleep at the gate, you know.
Yes.
So kind of that was the first one. Recently, did I tell you about the armed response? Had I done the armed response one by the time you and I were there?
Yes, you have,
So it's getting a bit more tricky, and I'm starting to be faced with guards with dogs and armed response. And this is, you know, this is England. This is the UK mostly. So that's a very unusual thing. But obviously the targets are more and more serious, and that happens. And things get very, very...
It's a fine line, right? Because you're...
It's very, very fine line,
Julie.
You
hate to do this, but you're, you know, for your part, I mean, all joking aside, it is quite a dangerous job because you are trying to do something that you're not supposed to do, or should I say that somebody is not supposed to be able to do.
Well, no one will know. So there'll only be security won't know. So the security on a site will assume that you're a real intruder very often. So there'll usually be head of security and maybe one board member that'll know that a test will take place. They won't necessarily know what day we'll attempt it. Mm-hmm. And you know, that particular one, and, you know, there's been plenty of armed responses, but the reason that one stuck in my mind was because it was such a close call that we were on that site and there was an armed response because the target that we had to get to. So when I get to it, so a client will say, we want you to get into this room or that desk or this. And then once we get there, I take a photograph, leave a business card or declare. So that means I have a signed letter with the board.
Yes.
All the board signatures, and I'll take that letter out and say, you know, but something along the lines of, and I'm not joking, Julie, something along the lines of, no need to panic, this is a security assessment, you know, and nobody hit me or jump at me or something, this is fine, I'm standing down, and I'll put it down, you know, sort of put the hands up in the surrender thing. But obviously, if the target is particularly significant in some way, there will be extensive security on that site. And this particular site that I was still, by the time you and I did our gigs, I was still sort of laughing about it because the adrenaline, there was armed response, there was dogs. I hate guard dogs. From a lifetime running away from them.
Yes.
And they already had, obviously that was on site. And if we'd been rumbled, then it was a 1 minute window for a police response. So they were they were 1 mile away. So 1 minute, but that police response could trigger the guards or something. I don't know the exact details because I was too frightened to remember them. But as soon as any of the clients could press a panic button, that triggers the guards and they've got armed response. And I don't know what that really meant, but I knew it was a bad thing. And what happens in these things is someone within the client premises nearly always rumbles you, or they, and that doesn't necessarily mean they stop you, but I do a talk about this, and I did a talk with the seven people you meet in a pen test, you know, like the seven people you meet in heaven, the seven people you meet in a pen test. And what, there will be somebody who just looks at you and just in the back of their mind goes, that person's not right. This is if it's a daytime test when staff are in the building. That person's not right. Something's wrong. And what you have to do is you have to give them no time to think and get away from them as quick as you can. Because what most people then do is sort of register it and then go, oh, but I was about to buy a sandwich, or there's my colleague I need to talk to. And if you can get away from them and they can forget you quite quickly, you'll get away with it, you see, because they're too busy to really ponder it.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's deeply psychological.
Never give them time to think. Disappear quickly. And it's someone else. You see, at that point, it's someone else's problem. So they'll think, oh, that's a bit unusual. But the percentage of people who will actually act on that suspicion is tiny. It really is. But I always know when it's registered. And I saw it in this particular case. We had to get to a certain part of the building and do two or three tasks and then declare it. And there was this lady, and I saw her once, and then I saw her again, and I thought, and the second time, you know, if they see you twice, that's it. And I saw her just think, who are you? You shouldn't be here. Absolutely thinking about doing it. So I had to run, and you know me, I don't run. I had to run across to the other side of the building and go up about 8 flights of stairs. And then I was with my wing woman. I have a wing woman I work with on this particular job. And I said, we've got to do it now. Right now. And when that happens, we had to text the client and say to them, we're going for it now. And what they did is they stood down just for 10 minutes, the armed response in that particular part of the building. So in that 10 minutes, they got a code word that said, security test underway, you have 10 minutes. So we had 10 minutes to do it. And outside of that 10 minutes, if we were still there, there was an armed response as if we were criminals. And also we'd fail, which is kind of worse. So it's kind of good when you fail because it means the security's in place, but there's something at the heart of you as a pen tester, as a social engineer that wants, you know, you want to do it. And I knew that woman had seen me and I could see the guards and it just smelt wrong. And that was very, very scary. And I thought there's going to be a dog at my, you know, jump at me or something. But, you know, we did it and we got through and I felt like I was going to be sick. I did the job. It was great. All finished, mission accomplished, came out of the inner sanctum, came out through the staff quarters, went to a nice meeting room, cappuccino waiting for me, you know, you've done it. The client's happy. And just in that come down, I thought, I'm just going to be sick. I thought, I'm going to vomit. And I guess it was because, and you probably know this better than me, but it's that visceral, physical, all the adrenaline, everything of just being, you know, talk about putting yourself in a criminal's space. At that point, we had 10 minutes and beyond that, we were criminals. And it was so emotional. And that's the thing, the job done properly, you know, I see an awful lot on social media of people wanting to be social engineers, claiming to be social engineers, claiming that they've done this type of work. But you know, when you break it down and look at the post, it's about getting a free pizza or, you know, giving a security guard a cup of coffee and sneaking past. And actually, the job done properly is extremely dangerous, extremely serious, requires an awful lot of presence of mind and makes you want to throw up.
Right. It sounds fantastic. But I mean, on a very serious note, you raise, you know, a really, really good point there that, that I just want to pull out of what you've said. And that is that difference between the moral and the unethical is that feeling that you have, that feeling that this is my work. And whether you fail, if you call it a failure, that is you don't complete your mission. That's not a failure to the company. It's not a failure to your client. So it's keeping that in mind that if you don't get through, it means their security is robust and that's really what they want. And if you do get through, if you do complete your mission and you do get to the place that they want to test and they find that they do have insecurities, they do have gaps in their security mechanisms there, that you can then educate them. So it's a win-win, except, you know, you're going through that emotional mill. You've got to be on. You've got that adrenaline pumping. It's like doing any kind of covert work. You have to be so aware and so in tune with your surroundings, with the people, with what you're doing. And you're looking for those tiny, tiny little indications that you would pick up on that you've been made, and your cover can be blown. So, I could talk to you all day about this, Jenny. You know, obviously we've talked about this a lot. But we need to wrap this up. One last question. Do you believe, or do you feel, first of all, do you feel invincible? Do you feel that you could do anything, or are there jobs that you feel that, you know what, I wouldn't do it, I don't want to do it, I can't do it, it's beyond my capability? Or do you actually feel that you could pretty much do anything?
So that's such a loaded question. All right, so I wouldn't be as arrogant as to assume I could do anything. So I think there are some targets I definitely couldn't get into. I've not come across them yet. What I would say is I can't necessarily do it alone. So,
right.
And it's funny because I was only with someone talking about this exact same thing. With the proper crew, and it is a crew, it is a big operation depending on the size of the buildings and what we're looking at. With the proper crew, I'd attempt most places. I am not as fit as I was. So, back in the day, I had to be the one up on the roof. And I think I said, I always end up on the roof. Talking to some lunatic on the roof. And there's all kinds of really spooky stories, which are for another time. But but I try not to do that so much now. And really, I guess my vision going forward would be to train people in this very specific area. Because it is not unique, but close to being unique, what I do. So yes, that there are other people who can bring different skills to what I already know and what I've learned, improve everything that I do. And then perhaps in, 5-10 years, there'll be someone who actually would be invincible. And that wouldn't be a bad guy.
That's amazing. And I think that's a great place to wrap that up. So for anybody listening here, if you see a future for yourself as this kind of investigator, this kind of, getting into the social engineering, physical penetration testing, target hardening type work, then Jenny is a great resource. How can people get in touch with you, Jenny, if they want to do training with you?
So a couple of ways. I'm on Twitter at Jenny_Radcliffe, where I tweet out. We have tweet alongs to movies about social engineering and security. I have a podcast, which is on iTunes and elsewhere, called The Human Factor. And I interview people about this area of working about security generally. And the website at the moment is www.jennyradcliffe.com, but is about to be changed to The People Hacker. So either of those will lead you right to my door, if that's where you want it to land. And there's lots of blogs and resources on there. You can always find me.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Jenny, as always, to talk to you. I always enjoy our conversations and always enjoy our time together. So thanks so much for everything that you've shared today. And hopefully people will get in touch with you and to either work with you or do some training with you. So again, thanks so much for being on and, helping to develop the next generation of world-class investigators.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Julie. Take care.
Well, once again, thank you for listening and for your incredible support. If you're not already a part of the world-class investigator community, find me on Twitter at HuntedJulie, and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. Until next time, take care.